Welcome to the Musicians Insider. I'm Cronus, and today I have a wonderful guest named Karen Bliss. And Karen is in Toronto and has done a lot of really great work in the music industry and philanthropy work as well. So I'm going to let Karen introduce herself tonight so she can tell you a little bit more about what she's been up to.
You're taking the easy way out. You're leaving it up to me. All right. I've been a music journalist since my teens, written for everyone from Rolling Stone to I'm the current Canadian correspondent for Billboard, lots of trade writing. Just write for tons of different places. And I also have an online magazine about giving back called SamaritanMag.com.
And that's been around for almost 10 years now, or how many years have you had that?
I've had it for 10 years. I wish the audience numbers would reflect that, but I've got some changes coming up. It kind of was just a side thing I was doing, even though I got some great interviews with everyone from Metallica to Larry King, but give it, my all, not my all, because I'm still a music journalist, but I'm going to make some changes, do some changes to the design. And
I thought that was a really cool concept. Just Samaritan Mag basically tells good news instead of telling bad news. Love all the outlets out there.
I actually explain it as shitty news, but it's good people trying to change bad things, because every story is shitty, right?
Well, I think they end up good.
So sometimes the issue is too big, right? Because we've got cancer, environment, Alzheimer's, clean water or lack of clean water, just all those things.
Fair enough. Well, so how can people contribute to or help with the cause?
They can read the stories. They can share the stories. They can advertise, sponsor. All the pieces are original. They're written by professional journalists, most of them music journalists. We've interviewed some amazing artists for it. It's not just, it is music heavy for obvious reasons, but we'll also cover, a corporation, a big bad corporation, but their corporate, charity platform. Maybe there's products where a portion of the proceeds go to a certain cause. We cover everything. Like, you'll have to vet the charities yourself, put it that way.
Understood. But I've always felt that since your journalism is filled with integrity, and a lot of people don't have that. And that's what I like about what your style is with the music journalism and everything. So when you choose causes to get behind, I already know they're coming from a place where they've been pretty well vetted, at least to make a story better, or you wouldn't even talk about it. And none of it's sponsored. It's all real.
So. Yeah, I mean, it is hard. I can't vet the charities, and I really don't, but I am selective about what we cover. So, if it's just for an example, just someone trying to there's the ones that you're like, I'm not so sure about that. But if it's coming from an already established charity, it doesn't have to be a registered charity. If I know that that person's going to, say, El Salvador and actually using the money to go purchase goods for an orphanage, which is something I actually did with some friends, we can cover that. Like, I'm sure, we've seen in Toronto actually some big charities, long running charities, where, the executive directors embezzled or stolen the toys and that kind of thing. So it's way too hard for me to personally like vouch for these charities. I don't know what goes on there. I don't have the resources, to get into that. And that's why we don't say, donate here. We put a link, if someone wants to do their own research, if they want to go donate, that's up to them. We just tell the story, like whatever the story is. So
very cool. So one thing I've noticed just following some of your Facebook posts and things like that over the years, I know I've known you for a while now, and you're probably wondering what the hell I'm doing, but I still do lots of internet marketing consulting and things like that. And this is my new podcast. This is like episode 11 or 12 now. And I'm really trying to do something that's not about me. So it's called The Musician's Insider. I know a lot of people, so I'm trying to get the coolest people I can. And you're in that group on here. And what
that's a very, very low bar.
Now.
You got to raise your bar a little.
I think the guests on here are pretty good. And I put you in that category regardless of what you say.
A little last minute. Like,
but what I was going to say was what I've noticed over the years is like you will sometimes vent about stupid things musicians do. And it's really helpful to see that. And like, I know how it works. And I really do my best not to annoy reporters with, look at this, look at this, look at this. But I'm sure we did that in the 90s when we were coming out with our stuff at the beginning. So I know one of the things I'm really asking for is your advice to new musicians on how to approach things like more about what your field is. So I know you're not a PR person, you're more of a journalist, but even things like publicity that will come across, like what kind of articles are helpful and what are things that maybe people should avoid doing, and you know, some advice on things not to do. I think that would be really awesome to hear from you. And if it's not where you want to go, we can talk about whatever.
I mean, there's not a lot that you shouldn't do. I mean, do whatever you can to get people to pay attention to your music, but really ultimately the most important thing is the music and the songs. That's not to say that you shouldn't understand the business and take those steps to understand the business, because if that's what you want to do for a living, then just like in any other industry, you have to understand it. Later, when you know, when there's too much work, then you need a manager, then you need an agent. But I'm not really into this, like, I'm an artist, like, I don't know about business. Well, then you're going to get screwed and you're not going to make a living. You're going to have a day job. And you can write your songs and play them, you know, at your local play bar, which there's nothing wrong with that. But if that's not your goal, then invest in yourself the same way one would going to school or interning somewhere. Like, attend Canadian Music Week. I know it's expensive, but it's not that expensive. And the access you have to all those people is unprecedented. Everyone who's anyone flies in from the States, from Canada, from all over the world, and they're there. And they're there because they want to be and they want to impart their knowledge and be helpful. You can approach the top producers, the top A&R people, publishers, managers. You can learn about things that, you know, maybe you don't know much about, like NFTs and blockchain and, you know, licensing and all those types of things. So that would be my number one advice to musicians. So the business.
So Canadian Music Week this year, because of the pandemic, was online, and I jumped into a bunch of Zoom rooms, and it was really cool to be able to just talk directly with some of the people running it, because basically they're the moderators and they're making sure that this is going to fly, because there's no room of 500 people. It's all online, so they're really going to give you the attention. And a lot of people don't even know how to use Zoom, so they don't bother. So here I am, now we've filtered out a lot of the people who ask annoying questions and don't know what they're talking about, and it enabled me to sort of make some really good solid Canadian connections, because I just moved back from the US in March of 2020. That was a really good thing to, in the last 2 years, go over anything or online. There's been a huge opportunity to do things like MIDEM conference online, and even Loop and Ableton Loop in Germany, and things like those things you can, yeah. And even NAMM.
Sometimes those panels and keynotes are archived for the people who have purchased the pass, so you don't have to watch it live, and then you can go back. But I should say, but that by saying, you know, people are asking annoying questions, that is the type of thing that I feel intimidates people not to ask questions. And I suggest people should ask questions. So to me, there's no such thing as an annoying question or a stupid question. Like, I feel like if you're going to invest and attend these panels, like, yeah, maybe prep ahead of time and don't just be silent. Granted, a lot of the panels do provide all the information that, you know, is intended during that hour, but you know, if you have a question, ask it, you know. And I know it can be intimidating to stand up in a panel and ask your question, but no one's going to moan. And there really aren't stupid questions.
Yeah, so only stupid people. But I think
the question actually is when people do like go on and on, like, I've got this gig, and what, like, you know, do get to your question. But other than that, like, I don't think there's any stupid questions.
I think there really is more annoying requests when someone like emails you and asks you something preposterous, you know, like that kind of thing. I think that's more what I was getting at. Like,
I mean, I do feel bad, and this happens a lot. You know, I don't have a ton of followers on Instagram. I'm not on there a lot. I don't, you know, I'll get there. But, you know, on Facebook, there's a lot of people on there. I probably know 200 of them out of 4,000 or more. People will like send me private, like the DMs, and they'll say, can you listen to this? Or what do you think of this? Or can you send me? I don't have time. If I did that with everyone who asked, I would have no time to, you know, have a coffee. Like, I just can't do that. And it's work. If I listen to your music, that is work for me.
And what do they expect to gain? What do they expect to gain from that?
Well, I get it. They want feedback. And it's tough, but you have to build relationships, you know? I do appreciate sort of, because I've done it too for my other projects where I just cold email someone. And most of the time, no one responds. And I get it. It is nice when someone responds. And I was going to make a concerted effort that, like, whoever messages me, I will take that time. But it's a lot of time.
Well, maybe your message might say, I received your music. I'm very busy, but I don't want to leave you hanging and let you know that I did, you know, take a second, or at least I have it. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to give you the feedback you want, but you might get some better feedback from, and you send them a resource.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. Like, I'm mainly a trade writer, and not only am I a trade writer, I'm the Canadian correspondent for Billboard, and Billboard is US, and people don't necessarily understand that. There is no Billboard Canada. I can't just write about whatever I want. They're extremely selective because the international editor has the entire world that, you know, he's assigning stories to. They're not gonna cover an unknown act, you know, who just released one song. It's just not gonna happen, you know?
And I get that. And some advice might be, what's the kind of thing they would cover?
I mean, why would it matter though? Like, why not like start locally with, you know, more appropriate publications that cover, you know, do 100 reviews in you know, like Exclaim or Now and those types of things.
So, like, I've been out of the loop. Is Now and Exclaim still around?
Exclaim
Chart Attack.
Around. I believe Now is still around, yeah. I don't know if it's physical anymore. I've barely left my house, but, you know, yes. There's tons of bloggers. I know there's crap bloggers, but there are tons of bloggers and podcasts. You know, I think it's common sense in a way what Billboard covers, or read Billboard even more. When I get messages from publicists, top publicists that say, you know, if I request an interview, oh, is this for Billboard Canada or US? I'm like, whoa, like, do not know your job. There is no such thing as Billboard Canada. Like, find Billboard Canada for me. So I do feel that people aren't actually reading the publications that they're pitching and approaching.
I find people don't even read their own Facebook posts that link to stuff. They just share it. You know, like, it's really bad. Lately, people's attention spans are so small. But that's an opportunity for artists, though, who want to perform like a DJ instead of like a cover band anymore. I'm finding you can jump from song to song halfway through them, and no longer are you frowned upon for not playing the entire 11-minute song. You are actually losing them after 3 minutes anyway. It's so weird how the entire internet generation has just changed things. So, building on advice for new musicians and new artists, what do people need in their press kit these days? Do you happen to know? I know this is, you're a journalist, but I thought I'd ask you that.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I want a good bio that isn't made up. So you're not from outer space. You're not the greatest band since the Beatles. Just like an honest bio with the facts I prefer not hiding stuff. So if you were in a band before and you don't speak to the drummers, you don't want to mention them, like, you know, it's just put in the name of the band you were in, you know, like if you put out three albums.
Well, something. Sebastian Bach does not talk to Skid Row.
Yeah, I'm bio like says a little like that he was in Skid Row, but I'm saying at a you know local level, yeah, just a good bio, a great photo, not against the wall, not a headshot ever, preferably not. I mean, you could do black and white and color. Make sure it's horizontal. Those would be the only two things. If you're really like getting some traction, maybe do like a one sheet, but that's it. That's all you need.
And so what's exciting you lately? I know you went to a few concerts because you finally could and you've had issues with the rain and whatnot, but what artists are exciting you these days and what's exciting for you lately?
The one artist I'm loving that I hope just gets bigger and bigger and plays bigger stages and tours the world is Jonathan Waugh. And, you know, he has put out quite a few albums over the years and he's been at it, but his dad is Patrick and he also was pursuing hockey to some degree, but his passion was music. And he put out a couple of records, I believe. And then Corey Hart was introduced to him. And then Corey was working with him and releasing stuff through Warner. And then he went out on his own and his new stuff is just amazing.
Now that's Warner Music Canada, correct?
Yeah, he's not with Warner anymore, but okay. His new stuff's great.
So being where you are in the industry, I'm going to ask you about how that works, because this is very, very confusing to some artists. They don't realize that there's a difference between Warner Music Canada and Warner Music America, and that if you're signed to Warner Canada, it's a domestic deal. You may end up needing a day job just to like get by with your career. And how would you respond to something like that? Would you recommend artists just take what deal they can get, or is the Canada deal a death warrant for your global career?
Geez, I don't see it the same way you do at all. I don't see, you know, just having a deal with Warner Canada means you need a day job at all. Yeah, it's the same as anywhere else. I don't really understand that.
Well, the amount of volume, like 50,000 records is gold, 500,000 records is gold in the States, because Canada's so much smaller, the revenue is different. And I was just kind of worried that if you do sign a Canadian deal, like Avril Lavigne didn't sign a Canadian deal, neither did Alanis Morissette or Sum 41. Now Sum 41 was with EMI, but I believe that was that a US deal?
Well, they were signed in Canada and then they also did a deal in the States. Sometimes there's joint ventures, licensing agreements, like all kinds of things, but there's like hundreds of bands that make a living in Canada and in Canada only. I mean, look at Blue Rodeo, look at the Tragically Hip.
But those are anomalies. Blue Rodeo and the Hip have put in their dues and they
I mean, I don't ask for people's bank accounts, but like there's tons and tons of artists that's all they do. Like in Canada, they work very, very hard. They play gigs, they, you know, record. We've got lots of government grants and aid and that kind of thing to help.
So don't be afraid of the Canadian record deal. Okay, I'm asking because I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's been almost a myth and almost a thing. And I know, I mean, that if you're
if that was true, there would, like, do you think all these like hundreds of artists like would be like signing deals and putting out records with majors? Like some have families to feed and, you know, rent to pay and mortgages and those types of things. Like it wouldn't even make any sense. Like, why would they bother?
Well, right? I'm just not sure.
We wouldn't have a Canadian industry if that was the case.
It seems like the only thing that really is a saving grace for that is the CRTC laws of like the CanCon 35% on the radio really helps with that. But it seemed to be they were only playing like the major labels bands for a while on that. It was kind of hard to, I don't know how to get radio. It's so hard. Do you have any advice on radio?
I mean, it's not the be all and end all, you know, like to me, build your audience. Like don't try and skip steps, don't have, you know, band envy, work, write great songs. I find the There's a lot of artists that like always complain about other artists, but their material is just not that good, you know? So they might look at a Justin Bieber, but I'm sorry, that guy plays every freaking instrument. He's been working since he was a kid. You know, he bust, he worked his ass off. He puts on an incredible 2-hour show. I don't know what that takes out of him. And his songs are catchy. So, you know.
I can't get into him, but I respect and agree with you that he's doing great. Sure. I thought the smartest thing he did was the Jack U thing. Like, he played with them, which is Skrillex and, you know, Diplo. So that was pretty smart. I do a lot of the Burning Man scene and all that stuff. We run skate camp, and I've spent a lot of time listening to electronic music now. So it's opened up a whole other world of compilation kind of, or collaboration things that I never thought existed.
I mean, to me, the things that musicians should do starting out are network, make friends, go. I mean, I'm talking like in not a pandemic, you know, go to open jams. A lot of those musicians, especially in Toronto, are top musicians who tour with other top artists. And when they're home, they love music so much and the camaraderie in the city, which is incredible, that they are at these events. Sometimes they're hosting them. So like, go to the one at Supermarket. And, you know, Orbit Room's no longer. I think they're going to reopen somewhere. But like, go where the musicians are. You might find your Keith Richards to Mick Jagger, Bernie Taupin to Elton John, that person that you're going to write amazing songs with. Be nice to people. You know, I don't know, just network and build up, and people will, you know, think of you. If you're portable, even better. Like, if you can play your songs on acoustics, you can hop on stage and open for someone. If someone drops out, like, be accommodating. Go on stage when you're supposed to go on stage. Go off the stage when you're supposed to go off. You know, if you're the first band on, don't wait until the venue starts to fill up. Go on when you're scheduled, because you throw everyone off and you're going to piss off the booker, and they're not going to book you again. Bring your friends and family out. Don't just like wait for everyone else to do the work for you. I mean, those are the things. That's what you got to do, you know?
And I think my audience will appreciate that advice very much. So that's really cool.
Also,
so
let me just add, don't leave after your freaking set. Stick around for the other artists and support them. Don't just take off after your 40-minute set.
So in 2008, I moved to LA for a while, and I joined a 7-string heavy metal band called Unraveled, and Jesse Bilson on guitar, and then some other people who don't matter as much, but he's fantastic. And we played the Whiskey, and as soon as we got off the stage, like, it was just so weird. Like, before we got on, like, we had sound check and everything, and we were watching. Then suddenly this band comes on, all their friends come inside from outside to watch them. And as soon as they're done, they all go back outside and they don't care about any of the bands. But like, they had this thing where fans would not watch the other bands. It was a huge sort of cutthroat, pay to play, shitty LA Sunset Strip crap thing. And I just was very not into that. I said, I'll do it once because they wanted to play there, but never again. So I thought that was interesting. Actually, that band ended like a year and a half later, but I did take a song or two for my projects. So I'm pretty excited to show those songs at some point. Very cool. So let's see, is there anything else you think you want to share with our audience? Just that might be some advice for musicians, for the Musicians Insider, that I haven't thought of. Any ideas?
I mean, there are a lot of songwriting workshops and camps. You know, even the best songwriters, the artists that are young and they've written these killer songs, and you're like, whoa, you wrote this song when you were a teen, you know, if you look at Zeppelin or those kinds of bands, like, but even now there's like young people, like if you look at Billie Eilish, right? Yes. You always get better. You're gonna get better throughout your life, experimenting, being really discerning and critical of your stuff, collaborating, being open to input from other songwriters, producers, A&R people, publishers, you know, people that have that ear. And even hitting the road, you'll come back better players, you know, just more intuitive and more creative and more comfortable. So I feel like, you know, always register your songs with the PRO, like in Canada, it's SOCAN. They have tons of workshops and things. I shouldn't say tons, but you can call them and see what they have. Camps where you're like thrown in over one day or 2 days and you're teamed up with someone and the three of you go off, like, you know, and you write a song and then you play it at the end of the day and maybe that song gets placed later. You know, there's a lot of them. If you look online, a lot of them are run by established songwriters. There's memberships you can pay and there's online workshops. And those are really helpful because you're going to meet other songwriters and artists. And, you know, and maybe when you do a tour next, like you can stay on their couch or open for them and utilize their audience. So, yeah, it's definitely good to make friends and to learn and be open. If you're arrogant, it doesn't really get you very far unless you're Oasis, but that's like a separate thing.
That's their bio.
You have humor. but yeah, that is something pretty important, I think.
Very cool. I just lost the three things I was going to say to you, but an idea I learned. So you said go on the road, woodshed a little bit, get better. Example for me was I had in 2005, I remember I toured a record I released and one of the songs on there was called Gone. And I used to play it live and I started doing the solo a little different live. I'd embellish it and add all these little parts to it. So then come 2020, I finished another album and I did a song called So Gone, which is like a redone of that. I added a rapper to the front of it. And the solo, I played the live solo that I'd been playing live. And I just put that on the record. And it's now when I play it live, I play it exactly the same way, but it evolved from the live show. So like, you know, you see like Metallica or the Stones, when they do certain songs live, they add a few little things here and there, or Joe Satriani add some live stuff to his song. I covered a Satriani song when I did my version, I added all his live fills to it instead of the studio version. And to me, that embellishment kind of stuff is really cool. So I love the idea of getting out and playing live as a test. Another piece of advice I guess I'm gonna give too is I made the mistake in 2005, oh, the poster's not on the wall, I took it down. We played at the Horseshoe Tavern 2004 and we invited everybody out. It was my first show, like bad idea. Like go do 20 shows before you invite everyone to be at your show. Because by the time we were loaded in and sound checked and everything, I was ready to go to bed. So my show was weak. I wasn't in a good spot and we hadn't really worked out the kinks of on stage banter and whatnot. So it sucked. And,
I mean, that's good advice because I have to admit, if I do go see an artist and I don't think they're great, I probably won't go see them again. You know, maybe 2 years later or 3 years later. It depends how bad they are, right?
Exactly. And don't chintz on the video. Make a good video. Solid.
I mean, the other thing is, you know, I do like banter within reason, depending on the style of act. So if you are solo and you're acoustic, don't just like play song after song after song, like tell the story behind the song, you know, and because I think those are amazing.
People love that stuff.
Yeah, I love it. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. Like people love that too. You know, like there's a charm to that. You know, if you're a rock band, it's a different thing. Like maybe just get on with it kind of.
So if you're a rock band, create moments in your show where maybe the guitar player and the singer come to the front of the stage for a certain part where it's like a moment of the audio and it pauses and drummers are laying back and the bass player is getting a drink or something where people will have those memorable moments. I think those are very, very crucial.
I have seen, and I feel this is a mistake. I don't know if others feel it too. I've seen artists not gauge the audience. So I've seen a new artist get on the stage at like a Horseshoe and there's not really anyone there perhaps. And they start doing the overhead clap thing and trying to get people to clap. That is not a good thing to do.
Work the crowd when there's a crowd.
Yeah, it's very hard to get people to clap. You know, unless you really are at an arena level, it's not very cool to clap. So people aren't really going to be doing that. You know, don't divide the crowd if there's no crowd. Like, maybe stay away from the cliches. Yeah, I think the thing is, like, it's just like if you went to med school, like, think of all those years of prep, you know, an internship or articling as a lawyer, you know, that kind of thing. Like, you have to pay your dues. That's just the way it is. And part of that is treating it as a full-time job. So you wake up, you're right, make it a discipline. So every day you get your coffee, you shut the door, you like write, even if it's crap, because sometimes what happens in those, the catalog of material, whether it's little bits and pieces, you might go back to it years later and there might be something there that, whether it's a phrase or, you know, something, a melody, and use it later, but just make it part of your day.
I have a box of tapes from when I was a little kid, like 16 to 25. I had, that's my, I don't know, 16 to 20-ish. I had a 4-track that I was using that a friend showed me how to use, and I recorded so much crap on there. I went back through them and I found a song, and I, 25 years later, put it on the new record. Like, I'm just like,
yeah.
And it works, you know, I mean, we add a bunch of, you know, EDM sort of tool sounding stuff, make it a little bit more now and stuff, but it's the same damn song. And I couldn't believe I found a recording of it where I had a friend of mine sing it. I had it on a piece of paper. I'm like, sing these lyrics. And we recorded it. And I just recently found it after I finished the song that we re-recorded. It's called Scream. And I played it and I'm like, wow, they're pretty much the same song still. That's really cool. So I don't think I personally have a shortage of material. I have so much crap I'm trying to get out. And even I was talking to Graham on the podcast yesterday from my old band, Thermocline, there's riffs from that band that I'm like, I'm going to use this guitar riff because it's awesome. And I can't wait to show you what we do with it. And even the last record I did, I now have a friend who wants to mix a song with me from that. And I'm like, okay, well, that's going to go on the next album. And there's a lot coming with that. But there's so much opportunity with all your own material that you can really revisit anything you've ever written and just kind of don't throw it away. You never know what's going to be something. I've had a friend say, Aaron, remember that song you did? I have a song called Change. And he's like, you should totally do that song. And I was like, well, you know, and then I went, reworked it. Now it's like one of my favorite tracks that we have. And I really wouldn't have done it unless that friend of mine had encouraged me to do it. So yeah. It's so neat to see things evolve. And for me, so I've never had any children. I'm still single. I've been working on living in the States and getting back. So to me, these songs are kind of like my family.
Right.
I'm not going to...
A big family.
I'm not going to say that they're like... People get mad when you compare dogs to children, but I'm going to say this: these songs have grown with me and evolved and they've matured. And so to me, that's...
You haven't, but your songs have?
I'm never going to grow up. And that's my advice to all of you out there.
I mean, I do have to say also, it is very hard to make a living as an artist. As it is, I'm a self-employed music journalist. It's also very hard. You really have to
May have an article that goes big, but then they don't put it on the radio and keep playing the article. So how are you supposed to make money off an article that was good? You might get some residual, but it ends. So,
but with music, I mean, it is hard, right? But there's nothing wrong with, I liken it to, like, I would love to write the cover story for Rolling Stone every single month, or even one cover story. I never have. That doesn't mean I'm not successful at what I do. That is something I would like to do. I probably never, ever, ever will. You know, you might never, ever headline Budweiser stage or the Scotiabank arena. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with playing a weekly gig at a pub for an audience that loves what you do. And maybe you have a recording studio and you record other bands. Maybe you play on a cruise ship and maybe you're like in the pit at Hamilton or something. Like, those are all fantastic ways to make a living, or teaching kids and passing on that legacy of music to others. Like, there's so many things you can do with your talent that doesn't have to be like, I have a single, or, you know, I'm signing an autograph, or I'm on this big stage. Like, that shouldn't be what it's about. And it shouldn't be how many followers you have on Instagram or TikTok or all that nonsense. Like, that is not the way to go through life. Right.
The problem is I did ask on my podcast, a producer, pretty big producer named Steve Thompson. I asked him, what would you recommend? And he said, well, you need a big social media following for anyone to look at you. That was the first thing he said to me. And I was like, damn, it's so annoying because that's that whole Instagram world of bullshit, right? But the way to do it is to be a solid band, go up, play tons of shows, and you will get that following if you do all the legwork. You can't just buy followers online. Like, you can't do it. And you know, like I work in the SEO world as my sort of day gig. I refuse to sell beer as a musician. Like, I don't want to play music to sell beer. That's not what I'm here for. I have a day job for that. And I try not to turn music into a life sustaining thing. For me, it takes the life out of it. I did a Molly Maguire's open mic thing in Ottawa for a couple of months when I got laid off of a job I had, and I hated it. And I felt like when I was up there playing the cover songs, I felt like this is degradingly crappy because I don't really want to play these songs. So I've taken my own.
People will look at that as this is a freaking fun way for me to make a living. Like,
it wasn't fun.
Playing music in a great pub, eating like a good, you know, burger and some fries, and I get my lager, and you know, like that's kind of cool.
The nights were too long for me. Like, it's like 8 to 12.
Yeah, I get it. It's a lot of work and a lot of sets and people are talking and everything. But you know, a lot of people I would imagine like think that's kind of a fun gig.
Oh, right? I was so excited to get that. It just wasn't for me, but I mean, other people do it really well.
Another skill, right? Sometimes musicians don't have another skill because they've worked so long trying to make it as a musician that they don't have other skills. So I don't think there's anything wrong with them taking that skill and playing at a pub or the places I mentioned.
100%. And for me, it's just like, I'm not trying to be diva. I'm trying to say, check your ego at the door, be nice to everyone, do what you can. However, for me, like I have been taking all this time trying to figure out how to work remotely so that I can tour. Everything I do is remote now. This podcast, I can bring this with me. I can set up anywhere. I just literally need to have a space to do it. And this I do every week, but I can, like, I stack them up. Like, so I did someone yesterday and I recorded you tonight. You'll be on in 2 weeks and they'll be on next week. So I have a bit of time to do things. You can easily, you can become more portable if you're smart about it. And like you said, if you're portable, you can bring your guitar acoustic and do something. So for me, I use a lot of technology on stage, but when I was with Thermocline and then with my other project, just my own solo project, it was difficult to reproduce stuff. We had to use an iPod where the left channel was all my vocal delays and samples and everything, and the right channel is the click. That's not well separated for the sound guy. So now we use Ableton and we send the bass out, everything out, but I don't even have a bass player. I just have a drummer and me. And it's like so much portableness going on.
Yeah, I mean, you're in that world, so it's probably a little different than what I am talking about, like through my history of music and live music. Some of my favorite artists that I never miss are artists that never sold tons of albums and probably don't have huge social media followings. Like Steve Pultz, all he does is tour all over the world, like literally. He's in Australia, then he's back to Canada, then he's in like the States and then back to Australia. And he's one guy, he's freaking hilarious. Like, you're on the floor, super entertaining. And that's all he does. That's how he makes a living. And people love him and then they follow him and then they'll never miss his show. Ours, O-U-R-S, Jimmy Nichols Band, one of the best singers you'll ever hear in your entire life, up there with like a Jeff Buckley.
Wow. I bet the other guy's happy.
Lana Del Rey wrote a song about him, but he's not like hugely, like widely known and hasn't sold a ton of albums.
Are they happy? I bet you they're happier than the other artists.
I don't know. I mean, I know some very happy, successful artists, you know, like the Billy Talent guys are some of the nicest guys on the planet. Like, to me, they've never changed who they are since I met them. And they work very, very hard. And they're all friends and lovely guys. So
another thing I was just out of nowhere, I thought I'd mention this. I noticed that during the pandemic, there was a few bands that got to play at the Elma Combo. And I was trying to figure out how that worked, right? Turns out Elma Combo Records, and they're all signed to them. I'm like, oh, How do you crack the nut of the Alma Combo?
It's not officially open yet, right? Really? I mean, you could, you know, like, they haven't opened.
Right, but you could do an online show with them if you were on their label.
I'm sure you could, too, if you phoned them.
And... I'm pretty sure you can't right now unless you're part of their team. That was kind of how that worked. That's what I found out.
I don't know. I mean, maybe that's just a we're in a pandemic thing.
Exactly. Right? But I was trying to figure out in the pandemic. That's why I started the podcast. But what can you do? Like, there's a place. I'm up in Midland, Ontario, where the MCC is here, Midland Cultural Center. We were trying to figure out how to do something from there, but... It just was such a fight to try to figure out, well, how would you even do it? And they just wouldn't go for it. So we're hoping to do a show there sometime with another local band here. Yeah. But
I mean, you can call the Elmo and I'm sure they'll answer you.
I'll have my manager call them.
You can't just like guess like, oh, they're only doing this without actually speaking. Well,
we couldn't figure out who to reach out to. And then what the deal was is that they're all on the label. And I was like, oh, that explains it. I'm not going to pitch to the label because I'm working on something else.
I don't know if that's the case, but sure.
So, but this isn't about me, but I do have a new record coming out soon, but we'll talk about that later. I don't want to have that on here. I'm a little excited and I like to talk about the details of things that have I've learned from it. Mostly be nice to everyone. and then you negotiate your contracts, get a lawyer. Don't do it yourself. I am recently learning more and more about how happy and thankful I am that I hired the right legal representation. Like in Toronto, usually it was Chris Taylor. I don't know who the big lawyers are now. Sanderson Taylor was a big thing. I'm working with an amazing guy called Ron Beanstock in New York City. Highly recommend their firm. If you have enough going on, give them a call. But it's tough.
I would recommend in the writing of a song, when you're co-writing, when you're collaborating, whether it's with a producer or a band member, be very careful who you give publishing to. So there are ways to give someone a piece of a song without officially cutting them into the publishing. So registering this, just be sure that if you're gonna give a quarter, a half, you know,
writer
to
share.
Someone, that they really did, you know, contribute. And in 10 years from now, when you're not speaking, you're not going to be bitter because they really didn't write anything, or, you know, they just changed two words. Like, you got to be careful with those types of things, especially with licensing that song later on and that production needing you to sign off that you own the copyright and everything. SoCan is great. Like, they are a nonprofit. They collect, you know, the royalties for you. And they're also there as artist liaisons to answer all these types of questions. So I might not even be explaining it properly, but they can. But you can't just like register a song with SoCan and change it. As far as I know, once it's registered, that is it, written in stone, and that's what it is.
So I've actually changed one after the fact, but to save money, that it had to be done. But let me explain.
Yeah, I didn't think you could change it after.
You have to have their permission.
Okay.
Everyone has to sign it to do that. And I made that. I'm like, you're signing this. Okay. But what I want to explain, because you just gave some really good advice. I'm going to give an example. So the writer's share can be 75% me and then 25% my producer, but then the publishing is 100% my label and my publishing company. So that's it. So what I did was I found a fantastic producer, Parker. He lives in LA. He's from Excellent Sound. Parker Amont, A-M-E-N-T, I love that guy. Without him, I wouldn't have the record we did. But what I'm getting at is I made him a flat deal at the beginning. I said, look, I love the way we write, the way we work. I don't want to nitpick and argue with you. So even if you do very little on this track and a lot on this track, I'm giving him 25% writer's share across the board on the album, just to make us now work creatively together and not concern ourselves with that. One of the biggest problems I found with 4-member bands, for example, is suddenly like one of the members wants to sing backups just to kind of put their stamp on it. And you're like, okay, here's the part. Right. And it just doesn't sound right.
But that's not a piece of publishing. I mean, essentially a song is still legally lyrics melody.
Oh.
What ends up happening is your singer's got, you know, a Ferrari and you're still driving your 15-year-old Honda Civic. And that's where the problems like.
Well, start. Didn't, is this, I think this is true. It might be a rumor. I believe Axl Rose forced all of Guns N' Roses to give him all the rights to everything, or he was going to throw the towel in, and they all had to do that at some point before the User Illusion 2. I heard that. I'm not going to know if it's true. I'll look it up and I'll put a link if it is. But that's the kind of thing you want to avoid. Like, I personally have no qualms with anyone I've ever played music with. I really have gone back with everyone and made friends. Like, anyone we've had issues with, it's all under the rug, except for one producer who tried to rip everyone off. And
right. I mean, the other thing I think some new songwriters, artists don't know is you don't pay a songwriter to work with you. You pay a producer to produce a song. You can pay for beats for a track if you're, you know, EDM or, you know, pop artist or hip hop. But if, you know, Diane Warren is gonna come write a song with you, you don't pay her. Like, that comes later with the end result, you know, getting released and becoming successful.
I went to the North Hollywood Music Festival, I think it was called, and she was a speaker there. And I got to sit in a room of like 20 people and she was talking. And Dionne Warwick's son was also there. And he told us the story about how he wrote Pink's Let's Get This Party Started. It's kind of hilarious. I'm just going to share it with you. He went into the bathroom stall, sat down and said, "Let's get this party started." Then he went, "Oh my God."
Really?
He said it.
I don't think I can listen to that song again now.
I'm sorry. I'm not sorry.
Every time I'm in the washroom, I'll think that.
Isn't that great though? Like, so like the weirdest things come out of those things. But that's, I heard that just being at a songwriter's workshop. And when I knew Diane Warren was there, I'm like, wow, I'm gonna watch her. I have a photo of her somewhere. I'll stick it in here. But yeah, really cool.
One of the greatest songwriters ever in the pop world.
So many songs. Very cool. Well, I think that's good. I really appreciate you being on the show today, Karen, and I'd love to have you back sometime. And if there's ever a big story you want to share, I would love to share it with people. And maybe someday I'll have a story that you can tell. I hope so. But until then, this has been the Musicians Insider. Thank you so much, Karen Bliss, for being here. And we will see you again soon. We'll be right back.